Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Thank you for being here. We have two bills that are scheduled for a public hearing and possible work session. I will state up front on the 2536A, we'll be taking that second. Today, the goal is to take public testimony, not to actually have the work session on 2536. And for those that are here, we more than likely are going to try to schedule some additional work on that bill tomorrow. House Bill 2226A, we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on that bill. Anna?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2226A as from the Oregon Commission for Women. It prohibits court from requiring a public hearing and notice for a name change application from a victim of domestic violence participating in the address confidentiality program unless a good cause is found by a court, requires the court to seal record upon application, declares emergency effective on passage. There's an A3 amendment. The A3 amendment clarifies that the bill does not apply to petitions for minors, including adult applicant appearing as a guardian ad litem for a minor. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. So let's see, I've got
Megan Jaco
and Bruce Miller are the two that are signed up. Please come forward. While they're coming up, is there anyone else who will want to testify on 2226A? Good morning.
Good morning.
So who would like to start?
I'll go first. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Megan Jaco with the Commission for Women. I'm also a practicing attorney that does pro bono work for domestic violence victims. And so that's kind of how this started, was with a client of mine that couldn't be helped under the current system. Ultimately, after about 3 months of pro bono work, I ended up advising her to move to California, where they have a program where she could do this. Oregon needs this. It's not going to help a huge number of people, but the people that it will help are among our most vulnerable citizens, so we think it's really important. I just want to make sure that you have all the documents in front of you. Does the committee have the written testimony that was submitted by the chair for the Commission for Women?
We have the Oregon Law Center letter that's hard copy, and we may have some stuff on OLIS.
Yeah, the letter you're referring to is on OLIS. Mm-hmm. The committee generally looks at those.
OLIS is our electronic system.
Very good. I can read it to you if you want to, or if you're able to. Good, we'll save some time then. What you have before you in the proposed amendments that you're looking at today, I think, is the last best version of the bill that hasn't really garnered any substantial opposition from anybody. I think everybody who's looked at it thinks that it's a good thing, and by limiting it to people who have already qualified for the address confidentiality program, I think that there are not a lot of technical problems. We do support the proposed amendments from the Judicial Department. I think that all the stakeholders who will have a substantial part in this, including the Oregon Law Center that helps the victims, DOJ, OJD, everybody's on board, and we're asking that you take a look at the proposed amendments and pass that with the due pass recommendation in the amended form. So unless there are any other questions, I'll pass it off to Mr. Miller, who can explain the technicalities of the amendments.
Yeah, we'll hear from Bruce first, and then we'll open up for questions.
Right. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller, Senior Staff Counsel for the Office of the State Court Administrator. The Dash A3 amendments come from work that Sybil Hebb of the Oregon Law Center and I did with some of her folks and our judges and court staff. We felt that the Ahengross version of the bill had some ambiguities in it and wasn't real clear on how the process should go forward. The amendments clean that up. We think we've gotten it about as clean as we can get at this time, and so we encourage you to consider those.
All right, thank you. Let me first ask the committee any questions. Okay, I do have one question, and that's basically, if the court, for whatever reason, determines that they think public notice should be required as it pertains to the changing of the name-giving notice, is there a process for the individual seeking that change to be able to withdraw that so they don't have to go through that process?
We believe that under the current structure, that's already allowed. You can dismiss your name change petition at any time, and that's why we have the provisions that even if the court doesn't waive the notice, that they can still seal the record so that person can't be found.
Okay. All right. I just want to make sure we have that on the record, and there's that, let's say, exit ramp if necessary. Any other comments or questions? Not seeing any. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2226A and open a work session on House Bill 2226A. Senator Dingfelder?
Mr. Chair, remove House Bill. Actually, don't we have to adopt the amendment?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So we need to adopt the A3. So, Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the dash A3 amendments into House Bill 2226.
Senator Dingfelder moves the adoption of the A3 amendments into House Bill 2226. Questions? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the House Bill 2226 as adopted, as amended with the dash A3s to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 2226A, or I should say as amended by the A3 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discretion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Dingfelder, please be our carrier.
Great, thank you.
And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2226A. And what we're going to do now is we're going to go ahead and open up our last public hearing that we have for today. And we do have some time restraints. What I'm hoping that we can do is hear from the advocates and the opponents over probably the next 52 minutes to an hour. We're going to kind of play it by ear to see how that goes, to give everyone an opportunity to be heard, and then we're going to take it from there as to what type of work group we'll be doing after that. And he's in the back. So, Representative Hovey, I'm going to have you go ahead and come on up since this is a bill that you've introduced. Did you want anyone to come up with you?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would. Nolan Robinson.
All right, that'd be fine. Yeah, I do. So go ahead and open up the public hearing on House Bill 2536A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2536A adds criteria for a court to consider when granting approval for selling a structured settlement agreement, requires statement 30 days prior to transfer on right to seek independent advice, and that payment for advice be through funds to be transferred, extends period in which transfer agreement may be canceled by payee, requires transferee to file petition with the court for approval to transfer structured settlement rights, and allows court to seal all or part of the petition. There is an A6 amendment. This amendment comes from the Oregon Judicial Department. This basically makes it consistent with the Uniform Trial Court rules about you can't actually seal a part of a petition. You have to seal the whole thing, and there's some technical details, and OJD is here. Bruce Miller is here to talk to that amendment if you need that. Thank you,
all
Mr.
Right.
Chair.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Paul Holby, State Representative, District 8 in Eugene. I appreciate you having the hearing on this bill. It's maybe perhaps a little bit obscure issue, but I think it's a very important one, and also one that needs some attention in our statutes. The purpose of this bill is basically to make sure that when structured settlements are transferred, that the best interest of the recipient or the payee of these structured settlements is fully considered, and that the transfer and the amount of monies that people get for these structured settlements is fair and reasonable. That's essentially the purpose of this bill. Structured settlements generally are payments to recipients who have suffered some injury, and it comes in a settlement form, and they're usually provided in an income stream that goes out into the future to make sure that the recipient of these structured settlements can essentially take care of themselves in the future because of usually the injury that they've incurred, and so the settlement is generally with an insurance company who represents whatever party happened to be at fault or something like that. And I think that approximately 90% of these structured settlements are due to or set up for injuries in such cases. Structured settlements, I don't want to give you a lot of history about them, but, they were set up quite some time ago, but in 2001, Congress took some action to try to end some of the anti-consumer practices that were going on with structured settlements and the selling and buying of these structured settlements. And so they instituted a 40% excise tax to make sure that there was a penalty for actually transferring these funds, because when somebody who needs these funds to survive sells them and then they end up not having enough money to survive, it ends up costing our governments more money as these people come to governments for assistance to help with their survival needs. And so that's sort of a ground lay. Right now, you can avoid that 40% excise tax if you get the transfer approved by a court or other authority. In Oregon, it's usually in our circuit courts where the judges approve these transfers. And this issue actually came to me from discussions with a couple of judges in Lane County who were talking to me about these cases. And our statutes, we currently have statutes that lay out how what conditions have to be met to approve these transfers, and judges certainly have the ability to reject these. But our statutes don't really give a lot of criteria or direction for the judges in really establishing what is the best interest. Is it a signature or an acknowledgement from the transferee that, oh, this is in my best interest because I want a new car? Or, and what kind of information is available to the judge to try to make those decisions? Unfortunately, judges don't have a lot of criteria. If the statutes are met, many of them feel compelled that they need to approve these transfers because the conditions of statute have been met, and the person that is the recipient or the payee of these settlements is saying, yes, I want to go ahead and do this. Sometimes it's hard to tell whether these recipients or payees are, fully cognizant of their decisions, or whether they're able to make decisions and understand the implications those decisions have on their future. And so this bill is meant to essentially give judges some more criteria and issues to consider in statute so they have a better standing to reject these transfer payments when they aren't in the best interest of the payees. And those things could include, what's your income stream? Do you have a job? Do you have future medical needs? Do you have ongoing medical needs? Many of these things are not disclosed in these proceedings. And though a judge may, of course, have the ability to ask those, understanding these transfers is pretty technical. And just the fact that a transferee says that, I understand this, these transfers are based on the net present value of a future income stream. And figuring that out is sometimes a little bit convoluted, too. Though most of these transfers do state, and I have a couple of cases that you've been presented with, but they usually state what the standard, the federal standard for the figuring the net present value of that future income stream is, and most of them disclose what that value is in the documents or in the agreement. And then it goes on to say, well, there's a net present value, but we're actually only paying you this. And so in between that difference, I assume, is where the organizations and individuals who buy these structured settlements, make some legitimate profits and pay for their cost of helping somebody go through one of these transfers. But usually those attorneys and those companies, and J.G. Wentworth being one in Peachtree, which I believe control, I think J.G. Wentworth bought Peachtree and represent a very large portion of the marketplace. And so when they end up offering that, they sometimes hire attorneys or have in-house people solicit the payee and say, we can give you cash for your structured settlement. If you need money, we can give you cash for your structured settlement. We can do it now, and it's your money. You deserve it. And, you know, they advertise, and some of those advertisements appear to be somewhat predatory when you consider that 90% of these people have been had these set up because of some injury and a lack of ability to take care of themselves. So that's of great concern, and I think that when you go into looking at what the disclosure is, the disclosure says under the federal standard, the net value based on a discount rate was 2.8% here a few years ago. I think it's 1.3% today is disclosed, and then the difference then of that value and what the payee actually gets is really alarming sometimes. In a case in Lane County, it was the net value was $33,000, and the payee got $18,000. Well, you know, I guess the money in between there paid for the attorneys to file the petition that are representing the purchaser of the transfer structured settlement. And of course, the profit to the company that's purchasing it, because then they can turn around and sell it on the marketplace somewhere else and make a profit at doing that. Nothing wrong with that. And there's really a lot of legitimate issues for actually cashing these out. But I think bears notice that, you know, the price that people are getting for these things is very, is discounted extremely. In many cases, and I think we provided some information to you about some cases around the country, and the one I just mentioned in Oregon as well. I've delivered that to the chair as well. So this bill is pretty simple. I mean, I wish we could put a cap on what people are able to charge for conducting these kinds of transactions, like a sales commission is usually 6% or something like that, based on what the net present value is. But we didn't go down that road. We talked about it in negotiations. We've had several meetings with the opponents and proponents of the bill, trying to come to some agreements. We never really reached agreements. But it is essential, I think, that we take some action in this arena to try to put some better light in our process and make sure that judges have the information and the statutory criteria to determine what the best interest is. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I know there's other people and professionals here that can talk more about these issues. I know that there has been another contention that we wanted the judge to be able in this process to say, I want you to go get another opinion, another quote or something, you know, at the end of the process. We actually drafted a bill, and they didn't. The opponents, I think, voiced a concern that they would have this money invested in filing this petition and collecting the information of the payee and presenting it to the court, and then only to have the court say, no, we want another opinion. And I can understand their concern that they would, you know, have this money invested, and then one of their competitors would come in and not have to go through near as much work with this. But if that's the case, it would seem like they would make sure that they had two quotes ahead of time going in. We've drafted an amendment that would require two quotes going in at the front end of this, but that was rejected by Mr. Romaine towards the before we passed this bill out. We didn't adopt that amendment, so it still gives the court authority to ask for another quote at the end of the cycle. I think that's reasonable. And if their concern is that they need to have two quotes, maybe we're disclosing that the judge may require two quotes, that they get two quotes at the start. I mean, one of our concerns is this a fair and reasonable deal for people? And do the judges have the right criteria in front of them to make a good decision? A lot of judges understand these things better than others, that's sort of the bill. I appreciate your attention, and I'd like to turn it over to my colleague.
All right. Before we take Nolan's testimony. Representative Hovey, what's your availability to stay? Because there are, I have a couple of questions regarding the farms, and I'm assuming these farms came, that were passed out, came from you, or did they come from Nolan?
Well, they actually came out of Nolan's documents. They were just pages that I plucked out of, okay, of these documents that show the...
I'll wait until Nolan...
Show the... What the payee was actually getting and the amount of the money that was involved is pretty shocking.
I understand that, but it also shows stuff that I want to question about. So, can you stay?
Oh, I can stay. You bet.
All right. Nolan, why don't you give us your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committees, our member committees. My name is Nolan Robinson. I'm a structured settlement consultant in Beaverton, Oregon. I am in support of 2536, which is, I think, a really good bill in that it helps protect people who have been involved in life-altering injuries. When we're involved in these cases, what we try to do is evaluate their needs, both their immediate and their future needs, with some understanding that you can't know everything. And then we try to address those needs, often when appropriate, by getting them some sort of future income stream. The importance of a structured settlement in that process is that it's not only is it a very good tax-free guaranteed income for these individuals, but that there's some built-in spendthrift protection, because the reality is over 90% of settlement proceeds are gone within 2 years of reaching of achieving a settlement. And that's, of course, assuming they take it in cash. People have proven to be not very good at protecting their money, and that could be because of bad investments. You can't always control what the market's going to do. A lot of times you have friends and family members who have genuine needs, and here you are with a bunch of money and an ability to help out, but it's not in your best interest to do so, but you do anyways, because you can't, it's hard to say no. And people often also simply make bad decisions on their own. They don't need a $50,000 vehicle. They don't need a 60-inch TV. They don't need a trip to Las Vegas in the high roller suite. Reality is sometimes this happens. And so a structured settlement is there to make sure that their future needs are the priority. And so it makes a lot of sense for these individuals. And basically undoing all that good work without significant scrutiny, I think, is simply just bad policy. And that's why I support the bill. And I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
All right. So, Nolan, it sounds like there's a couple of documents that were handed out to us this morning. Senator Close brought to our attention regarding some of the personal information that's included in there. So I guess I just wanted to find out if you... if one of them is for... It's a disclosure statement on the front for Paula Padilla.
Mm-hmm.
Is that one of yours? So I'm wondering, to me, I'm going to make a decision here that certain stuff, because it's going to become part of the public record, I disagree with having the date of birth on here, cell phone number, policy number, and her Social Security number. And it looks like you may have tried to black out, or someone did, on one place a Social Security number, but it's not blacked out in other places.
No, I apologize for that. I have no objection to keeping this out of the public record.
Well, we have in our state, we do allow people to have certain privacy of certain personal information. So the chair is going to, I've highlighted, and this is for the record on the background information of this one, date of birth, cell phone number, policy number, and then there's a Social Security number down at the bottom, and I will ask staff to black that out before it becomes part of the public record.
Thank you, Chairman.
All right. Other questions? Senator Roblin.
Yeah, I guess two things, if I understood it right, and I'm trying to figure this all out. And the first one to Representative Hovey. None of the information that you put in here couldn't currently be asked by a judge to be presented at a hearing. Is that correct or not?
I think a judge could ask anything they want in their own court, I'm guessing.
Okay.
I guess the issue is, what criteria does the judge have to reject an agreement that comes before him that discloses that accomplishes everything that's in current statute. And I think there's differences of opinions whether judges are comfortable rejecting based on criteria that's not spelled out in the statute. Does he have the statutory authority to do that? And, you know, some judges are more comfortable than others. Many judges are very knowledgeable about structured settlements, but not all judges are. And so, you know, just reviewing a document saying, well, this complies with the law, everything's checked off, the boxes are filled in, and they approve it without going down that road of asking some of those questions.
And I understand. I mean, my frustration is that I tended to be a principal who would like to have a general policy and then let me make decisions based on the information that I have. And I always like to do that with my judges. I mean, I think we've gone too far in prescribing what judges can do in a lot of different places. And I get a little nervous when I see a prescription, because then all of a sudden you leave something out of that prescription that would have been really good information, and they don't ask it because it's not on the list. So I get... That's just a statement.
Well, and that's exactly the issue that we're faced with now is that there is a small list, and so some judges don't go beyond it, and we don't feel the information that's in current statute is enough to make a decision. Nowhere in the list does it ask them to ask the question about somebody's future medical needs or whether they have a, you know, an income stream that's going to be able to help them survive in the future.
And do we know of any Oregon cases where, since this was revised a while back, so mm-hmm. Because like you were saying before, they didn't have to go judges, but now it's pretty much judges. Have there been any individual cases that have not been caught by the system or real atrocious ones that we know of that led to the writing of this bill, or is this preemptive as opposed to actual cases in which you could point out a person or a person that was hurt?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Roblin, I have heard of some cases like that, and you know, very cautious to give documents from the courts, right, that we've been able to get, just as the senators pointed out, because of the information that's contained in there. In many cases, these people don't want to let people know, especially the attorneys or the structured settlement professionals that helped them set this up to take care of them, that they're cashing it out. So there are abuses. The things that come up in the Lane County case that I looked at was essentially that the person only got around 50% of the net present value of their income stream. That doesn't seem like very much out of a, you know, for that. And is that a wise financial decision? And then the other piece of that was that in this case, every piece of our current existing law, that checklist was completed. And so there's that prescriptive list that's completed, and it's done. But there were some pertinent questions that weren't answered because they weren't required to be asked. The case was presented, and it met the statutes that we have. And so it really begs the question whether, you know, what I understand the issue about having a prescriptive list, but I would argue that we have one now that is very minimal. And, you know, judges brought this to my attention because they felt like, you know, do I really have a grounds to reject this because it meets the law?
And the other question, in a structured settlement, could it be listed by the judge or however it's finalized with a structured settlement that says they cannot in the future divide this up and go and get a loan or a whatever on it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roblin, the language in the settlement agreements does say that the payments can't be transferred, assigned, reduced, anything, without a qualified court order, which is what we're, you know, the factoring transaction and the order that happens. So to the extent that, you know, they cannot be transferred outside of that, But there's no way to prevent it absolutely.
Okay. So is it, when a judge is reviewing one of these exchanges, do they have access to the record and what caused the settlement in the first place and why, including medical records and that kind of stuff, as to what the expectation was about the settlement?
Typically, the settlement agreement is included in there, but the settlement agreements are typically quite vague about what it is. They typically will just say that this is for settlement of injuries within Section 104A of the Internal Revenue Code, which is the which states that the payments are exempt from gross income and whatnot. So it typically does not, unless you're looking at a workers' compensation claim where you're settling future medical, which is not frequently done here in the state of Oregon. But the reality is, no, we don't often know. But you know, you can be you can feel fairly certain that if we're providing monthly income, lifetime monthly income to an individual, it's probably because they have a diminished earning capacity. And every time, you know, they may not be making ends meet with the income that's coming in. I don't see how that's going to improve if they get $50,000 cash now for a payment of $500 in exchange for half of that of their payments going forward. And I don't know the extent to which the judges are aware of that currently. It seems to me that they're not as aware. And, you know, I think one of the real valuable parts of this bill is requiring a laundry list of information be provided in advance to the judge so that he or she has the best opportunity to know the full picture without knowing every question to ask. Now, hopefully, that information that they get in advance will, you know, spur some other questions in their minds. I would think it would. But I certainly don't see how it can hurt.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, just one thing to add. One of the concerns is that usually, from what I've been told, as I have no direct court experience other than watching a couple of these cases, is that the payee or the person that's transferring their structured settlement rights usually doesn't have any representation. And even though they make a statement that they've been advised that they can, you know, seek legal attorney or whatnot, they very often don't. They have a form like this that checks a box that says, I'm waiving my right to seek financial advice or seek a legal opinion on this. And, you know, they are dealing directly with the person that's purchasing these agreements and with an attorney that's representing those purchasers. And, you know, with the ads that I handed out that says, it's your money, you can have it now, and why wait, or, you know, those sorts of notions. It really is of a predatory nature, and, you know, I think that is one of the most alarming pieces of this, is that there may be legitimate reasons, I'm not discounting that, to cash out these structured settlements, but when they're basically based on one side and on a vulnerable population that doesn't seem to understand what a net present value of their future income stream is, and that they sign a bunch of documents, and in one of those documents happens to be waiving a financial advice, you know, I'm concerned.
All right. Wait a second. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. We got 12 minutes for this side. If you have a question, that's fine. But
I'd rather have other people speak so
that's
you
fine.
Can get
it. I'll just hold this right.
If you have a question, go ahead. But, you know, I'd like to
I
try
can
to
ask it offline.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So the next group that we have is going to be Stephen Hendricks, Jack Milligan, and Tammy Simpson. And that's all I have on the proponent side at this point. And and I'm not sure how you want to present, but whoever wants to get started, please
go
give
first?
Us your name.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Hendricks. I'm a trial lawyer of 33 years, primarily representing injured people. You know, these situations involving structured settlements involve the most severely injured people. On a typical case that is of smaller injuries and smaller consequences, we'll cash them out. So we're talking about the most severely injured people, oftentimes with head trauma or other kinds of brain injuries, and almost always, as you also heard, somebody that has lost either some or all of their ability to make a future income. So when you're looking at people that are this vulnerable, we oftentimes want to build in the idea of a steady stream of income that they can count on, come hell or high water, into the future, with that sort of spendthrift notion that they're not going to chuck it out, because historically we see that a lot of times people are either unable or unwilling to manage settlement funds appropriately. So yes, it is being a little bit protective of these people, but as the attorney who's trying to make sure that their future needs really are covered, and really trying to protect these people who are vulnerable, I think, and support Senate Bill 2536. Now, I thought the discussion about the idea of the list of things that the judge should consider was very interesting and very appropriate. I would encourage you to consider that throughout the state of Oregon, if we are going to have the judiciary make these kinds of decisions, having that criteria in the statute provides for uniformity of application across the state. So those are the two things that I hope I can add. My experience, that these are very vulnerable people and that they really need the protection that's put, that increases the protection for the consumers of Oregon in 2536, and that from going into court and listening and having a judge be able to understand more of the criteria, I think provides for uniformity. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Who'd like to go next?
I will. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jack Milligan. I'm the founder and president of Settlement Professionals, Incorporated. We are a firm that, an Oregon firm, for the last 27 years has worked with over 1,500 injury victims in the state of Oregon and even outside of the state in helping them plan their settlements. And one of our core planning tools has been a structured settlement annuity, amongst other financial vehicles that we use to help these people. I've been before this committee before, and you've heard some of my other testimony. Today, I'm reappearing, and I've also brought one of my clients so that you could meet a real person that's been affected by the very subject matter that we're discussing today. And in fact, in her particular position, she's got part of her story that I think is exactly on point to this discussion. And let me first say that I am not against factoring or factoring companies. I think that these companies actually offer a needed service, a liquidity service for our clients that do occasionally find themselves in a financial situation that they just can't get out of any other way. And that's really what has happened to my client, Tammy Simpson, next to me here. I met Tammy 10 years ago after she had just entered into a settlement of her case, and she had been involved in a horrific car accident on I-5 south of Roseburg, I think it was, with an 18-wheeler. It was a major recovery. It was designed to take care of her for the rest of her life, her medical bills. We got her a house, paid for it. And in a few years, she found herself in a financial situation. Mr. Robinson described how, you know, well-meaning friends and neighbors sometimes come and knock on the doors of our clients and have a sad story to tell. And our clients many times are apt to want to help them out. And in Tammy's case, her injuries were pretty horrific in terms of orthopedic injuries, but she also had a traumatic brain injury in this case. Bad enough that we've gotten a settlement, but not bad enough that she needs needed at the time a full-time conservator. So a couple of years ago, Tammy came to me for some post-settlement planning, having had some financial issues, and after involved talks, we decided that her only way out in that particular case was, in that particular instance, was to factor part of her payments. And we gave her some names, and she managed to factor a small amount of her annuity payments to cover her financial issues. And Judge Garrison in Douglas County was the judge that approved this, but he did it with an interesting caveat. He said, this is the first and last time that I want to see you in my courtroom. There will be no other factorings of your payments. These payments are meant to take care of you for your life. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
So then after that, Tammy, that's where things really started to kind of maybe go a little haywire. And I think you described seeing a commercial. So would you tell the panel what you saw?
Seeing the commercial from
Tammy. What I need you to do, just for the record, is tell us your name, and then you can tell us your story, please.
Yeah, I'm Tammy Simpson, and I seen a commercial on TV from J.G. Wentworth. It's your money. Use it when you want it. And I'm like, okay, well, I want it, so I'm going to use it. And I sold my structured settlement, and now I'm sitting with nothing. They didn't bother to tell me all that.
Now, Judge Garrison said that he would approve the first one.
Yeah.
But then you saw this ad, and you called these people?
Yeah.
And so did you tell them what the judge had said, that you weren't going to be able to structure anymore?
I told them that Judge Garrison told me not to come back into that courtroom, and they said, well, there's ways around that.
And what did they suggest that you do?
They wanted me to go into a different county, or say that I lived in a different county, and take it to a different county judge
and have it done that way.
And how did that work out?
Well, it would have worked out, but I wasn't there to collect the paperwork in the other county to sign for it. So it got, returned to them.
And did they also understand or find out that you weren't a resident of the county?
Yeah.
Okay. So then what did they suggest after that?
They wanted me to go try a different county and try to do it again.
And then, but then you've got three annuities that are in your particular situation, and you managed, or with their help, and over the objection of Judge Garrison, they found another judge in the.
Yeah, they somehow got it into a different judge, because it was supposed to always be Judge Garrison that did them. And somehow it got put into a different judge in there, and they approved it.
And did you appear before this judge?
I don't think I did. I really don't think I did. I can't remember.
Do you remember these answering any questions about your income or your medical situation or your head injury?
No, it was. If I did go, it would have been briefly, just to go in and say, yeah, I want the money, and I signed the papers.
But you don't remember that.
I don't remember, and I know I wasn't asked any questions about, future payments or anything, how I was going to live or anything like that. If I would have been, then yeah.
So this is an example of our clientele. She's a dear, sweet lady. Probably would have been a good idea in hindsight for her to have a conservatorship to protect her, but she didn't. And somehow in this next transaction that she got involved in, she has sold all of her income payments until 2025. She's got one small annuity that pays $1,000 a month for another year, and then it ends. And then all she has left is her Social Security disability. And I'm not saying that the factors were the root cause of her problems. That's not the case. Like a lot of people coming through the last 5 to 10 years with the economy and the financial system, and susceptibility to friends and neighbors that try to guilt people like this into giving them money, she's found herself in some financial difficulties. Only exacerbated by the fact that somehow in the second transaction, over the stated objective of Judge Garrison, who's really done a stand-up job here, somehow these people found a way to get around, get to a different judge, and get this approved and without any question. So to sum up, I'm in favor of this legislation because I think that there are parts of it in there that would require that the judges know more about these clients ask the proper questions and even see him and have him appear.
All right, questions. I do have one question, and that's regarding Tammy's situation. You said that she had three or four different annuities. Were they all a result of the injuries that she had suffered? Did they set up separate ones?
Yes. What I did, Senator Przanski, is instead of placing all of her money in one company, we divided it for safety and diversification. So she had two annuities that way that were paying, splitting her monthly income. And she's got a third one that pays for a shorter period of time, and it ends in 1 year.
All right, I understand that. And then my understanding is from what Judge Garrison said from the bench was basically she did not want to see Tammy come back in or regarding any others, a factoring. And I'm assuming that statement was for any and all annuities that she had been invested into.
Yes, that's our understanding.
All right. And since you know this case, have you done any follow-up to just find out which court, in the sense of it sounds like it was another circuit court judge in Douglas County that actually approved the second selling of annuities? Do you have any information as to who that might have been?
No, but I've asked Tammy to find the records for us so that we could take a look. It sounds like it might have been a pro tem or a judge that was sitting in for a Garrison while he was on vacation.
We can't find those. I've got a colleague here on the bench with me that we may be able to get that information. All right, any other questions or comments? All right, thank you very much. Tammy, thank you very much for coming forward and telling us your story today. All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to shift gears, and we're going to go ahead and I have four individuals who want to give testimony today opposing the bill. And so, Paul, why don't you come up, and if you want to bring a chair up and have all four up, that'd be great.
I've done this before.
I know you have. I just want to get everything on the record there. So while they're getting situated, is there anyone else that's here in the courtroom? I know Mr. Miller, Bruce, I know you're here for if there's any questions, but is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on 2536A? All right, so I've already have adjusted our time. You have about 40 minutes, just like the other side had 40 minutes. Actually, I cut in that you got 39.
So 39 minutes?
Yeah,
okay.
39.
All right, Mr. Chair, I understand your tendency towards fairness, so I appreciate it very much.
All right.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland with the Romaine Group, and I'm representing the National Association of Settlement Purchasers. With me at the table to my left is Earl Nesbitt from the association. He speaks Texan. That's why we brought him.
I got the Texans on each end, I understand.
Yeah, you got Texans on both ends, but with a little Georgian also on the far side. So we got a southern base here. Julie Weiss is to the far side, an attorney in Portland, and Roger Dunaway, who practices actually in three states in the Northwest. I think, Julie, do you practice in
Washington?
In Washington also, doing these kind of deals. I'll be very brief. Basically, the problem is it's sort of like the Sherlock Holmes novel when Watson asks Sherlock how he solved the case, and Sherlock says it was the dogs barking, and Watson said that, but sir, the dogs never barked, and he goes, precisely. There's no barking going on here. This statute, which was put in 2005, works very well. And we'll give you actually specific examples using the witness that came up here, but I'll let the folks at the table who know a little more. There's a confusion about discount rates, and discount rates are basically like an interest rate. The problem is that they're hard to compare because if you're getting a lump sum for something that's due 25 years from now, that's discounted a whole bunch. If you're getting something that's now for something that's life contingent, that could be discounted a whole bunch. But normally a structured settlement, the discount rate's probably going to be between 8 and 19%. Now, it's like an interest rate when you consider that your pawnbrokers and title loans and folks like that can go up to 36%. These are actually reasonably decent deals in a lot of situations. Roger has some testimony here that with some specific examples. And what I'll do is just sort of turn it over to Julie and then Roger and then Earl. We also are passing out the Dash 7 amendments that we had drafted with the chair's permission, that basically, if you choose to do so, we don't think the statute needs amending, but if you choose to do so, it presents, it does put out a laundry list of things that the judge might consider asking. It does take care of privacy concerns and things that are of concern to us and, frankly, the people that are selling their settlements to us. So with that, I'll turn it over to Julie Wise.
Good morning. My name is Julie Wise. I am an attorney in Portland with the law firm Hagland Kelly. My colleague Mike Hagland is the president of the Oregon State Bar currently. We have been in business for 25 years. I joined the firm in 1997, and one of the areas that I do practice in is the structured settlement transfers. I have been doing these transfers for about 5 years, and I agree that the Act works. I do believe that the Act works, and I also, I'll have to say, I appreciate that Representative Holvey and the other folks who have testified are concerned about Oregonians. I think we're all concerned about Oregonians. The way I differ, I think, from Representative Holvey is that I really have faith in the ability of Oregon Circuit Court judges to ask the right questions. And I was really struck by the conversation with Senator Roblin about don't the judges have the ability to ask these questions now? And I can tell you that they absolutely do. We engage in some serious colloquy with judges about these transfers. And Judge Carlson in Lane County, in fact, who is one of the judges that I believe Representative Holvey was referring to, he is one of the best and most thorough in engaging in conversation with these folks. I have high regard for Judge Carlson, and I can assure you that he is no wallflower. He does not feel as though he has to rubber stamp a transfer. I frankly don't think that any of our circuit court judges in the state are wallflowers. I feel as though if they feel that there is a reason to deny a transfer, they will. I just can't emphasize enough my respect for the current judiciary, and I have to throw in my pitch to tell you that they're all working very hard without adequate funding, so please do what you can to help them in that regard. I do believe that judges know how to ask the right questions, and I was struck by some of the testimony I heard suggesting that 90% of structured settlements involve these really grievously injured personal injury victims. Now, that might be the case, that the structured settlements are being set up for those folks, but in my experience, it is certainly not 90% people like that coming in to do transfers. In my written testimony, which I believe you have, and I just handed up some additional copies, I gave you a couple of examples of structured settlement transfers that I thought made particular sense. I was concerned that you might think I was cherry picking, so what I did was I went back over the files that my office had handled in the last month, and I found that there were only 4 transfers, and so I want to give you some examples so you can see that these are not brain damaged, grievously injured folks who are coming in and getting taken advantage of. A 34-year-old widow, 4 children, they ranged in age from toddler to teenage years. She transferred her rights to a series of monthly annuity payments that came due between 15 and 29 years out in the future. So they were really far out, and they weren't doing her a lot of good at the current time. She needed more immediate funds to pay bills that had accrued in the aftermath of her husband's death. She was the beneficiary of the annuity contract, not due to physical abuse, but it was I shouldn't say that, actually. It was sexual abuse as a child, so there was certainly a physical component to it, but she was doing very well. She shopped around. She negotiated a deal for herself that had a 10.6% interest rate equivalent. Another one of the 4, a 28-year-old single woman, no kids. She was a recent transplant to Oregon, actually from Texas, Chair Prozanski, and she was working as a computer repair person. She also transferred payments that were coming due pretty far out in the future, between 11 and 23 years. These were monthly annuity payments. What she wanted to do, and she engaged in a good conversation with the judge in that case, and that was in Marion County. She wanted to. She wanted to start up a business. She wanted to purchase some trailer homes, and she had actually gone and done her due diligence on these trailer homes. She had information about what they would cost, what she would rent them out at, and she wanted to be able to. She had lined up some renters, and she hoped that she could give people who were down on their luck a chance to get into a stable home and establish some credit with her. That transfer was approved. She shopped around beforehand, and she negotiated a deal that had a 6.53% interest rate. I have two more examples. I don't mean to bore you with these examples. I can tell you that of these four, the only one that involved a fellow who had had another personal injury was the last one, 45-year-old single man, transplant from the East Coast recently. He was going to be married soon. He had four kids, all under the age of 13. He wanted to pay for his wedding, pay for his nuptials. And so what he did was transfer his rights to three lump sum payments that came due 5, 10, and 15 years out. He had a work injury, and I don't know the nature of it because I was actually visiting family in the aftermath of my sister's recent passing, but I do know that he was able to work. He was working, I believe, in the custodial business, so I believe he was, even though he'd had a work injury, he was certainly back to work. This fellow shopped around also and obtained a 7.91% interest rate equivalent. So those are examples of matters that we've handled in the last month, and these are not folks who are coming in with brain damage. And in fact, if I knew that a person had a brain injury, I would certainly inquire very hard into that. And I would disclose that to the judge. And I would make sure that the judge asked questions about that. And it's very rare to have those circumstances. I did one time have a judge with a brain injured individual say, I want you to go and get a medical opinion telling me that you're capable of making these decisions. That's another example, Senator Roblin, of how judges are able to do what they feel is necessary to ensure that these things are in a person's best interest. I'll give you one more example real quick, and then I'll touch briefly on the payee that we heard testify just a moment ago. This is a transfer that I spoke with this woman this week. She hasn't gone forward yet with it, but I really thought this was it touched me. A woman in her 60s, beneficiary of an annuity contract due to her father's passing about 30 years ago. She's been receiving monthly annuity payments, pretty modest, less than $500, for 20 years. So she's gotten the bulk of the value out of that annuity contract. She wanted to sell the last 10 years of her payments. She also recently moved here from Texas, and I said, you know, why do you want to do this? Why do you want to liquidate? And she said, well, my daughter, my adult daughter, has cancer and has come back. And she's not doing well at all. We were living in Texas without family. She said we wanted to come back to the Pacific Northwest where we're from, and we wanted to be with family. And she said, I would like to buy a trailer home outright, and I would like not to have to go back to work right now so I can care for my daughter 24/7. And she said, this is what will enable me to do that. And she said, I would certainly think a judge would understand that and maybe want to contribute to my cause. And I thought, well, yeah, you know, that's how it struck me. So again, I mean, this is not a woman who was personally grievously injured. Her father passed. For 20 years, she's been receiving modest payments. She now desires to do something that she has determined that is in her best interest and that of her family. And I think that's a very good example of the types of folks who are coming before these very capable Oregon Circuit Court judges. And very briefly, I'm glad Ms. Simpson is here with us today, and I'm sorry she's had difficulties. I believe I was the attorney who handled that the transfer that was probably brokered by Mr. Milligan, is it? Mulligan?
Milligan.
And that was in front of Judge Garrison in Douglas County. Judge Garrison is a tough judge. He asks a lot of questions. One thing he likes to do sometimes before a transfer hearing is he sends a letter saying, come prepared to talk about A, B, C, D, whatever he feels is pertinent to the transfer. So he does a nice job with that. We had a hearing, and he was concerned. I was appearing by telephone, and he must have seen something in Ms. Simpson that I wasn't able to see over the phone because he said he wanted to have the money go into an attorney's trust account. She had independent professional advice, I believe, and it was going to go into that attorney's attorney trust account. And he said it can be expended for certain items. He thought some expenditures were reasonable and some were not. Unfortunately, the information about getting the monies to the attorney trust account as opposed to going directly to Ms. Simpson didn't get transmitted properly by my company, and we took full credit for that mistake. I called Judge Garrison up and I said, I'm sorry, Judge, the monies went directly to the payee. What do you want to do? He said, come back into the courtroom. We all came back in, and he said, where's the money? And unfortunately, Ms. Simpson had spent the money on things that he didn't think were appropriate. He was very unhappy. He was extremely unhappy, and I believe that might be what led to the statement that you don't, you know, you're not going to do this again. So it was an unfortunate circumstance, and I believe Mr. Dunaway will talk about subsequently that Judge Garrison did not the act work. And and Judge Garrison said, no, you're not going to do this again. That was my experience with Ms. Simpson, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have. But really, I guess my point is, based on my experiences, the law works. Judges know how to ask the questions that they need to ask. I feel as though they're being sufficiently protective of Oregonians. At the same time, they're recognizing the individual freedom that we all have to make decisions about what we want to do with our assets. So with that, I will turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Dunaway.
All right. Just time-wise, you got about 20 minutes for presentation. I do want to leave some time for the questions from the dais.
Good morning. My name is Roger Dunaway. I want to thank the committee members for allowing me today to testify in opposition to HB 2536A. I've been a lawyer since 1987. For those of you that may be attorneys, I have an A.V. Martindale rating, which means that your peers view your legal skills and your ethics as very high to preeminent. My credibility and reputation is key when I go into a courtroom, so I will never file a petition, as Ms. Simpson indicated, in the county where she doesn't live. And as a matter of fact, I did file one involving her for one of NASP members. It was Peachtree, and when I queried her and found out she didn't live in that county, I dismissed it immediately because I don't play those games. I adhere strictly to the law. For many years, I was with a firm based out of Portland, Ader Wynn. Many of you may have heard of that firm. It's well-respected here in Oregon. I was in their Seattle office. I'm now on my own. I practice in Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and this is a large part of my practice, and I handle transfers in those three states. Ms. Wise and I handle probably the bulk of the cases filed here in Oregon, and I think we can speak from firsthand knowledge as to what takes place in a courtroom based upon that experience, not what somebody told us or what you may have heard from some other party. I do want to also let the proponents of the bill know, I commend them. I know they're looking out for Oregon consumers, and I agree the current law does that as it now exists, but I think maybe this bill that we have before us might be based on some misunderstandings about the industry and about the process, and not some of the practical applications if these proposals would become law. I have a couple letters that have been handed out, and as I stated in one of those, being a personal injury victim knows no socioeconomic status. I deal with many people that are well-educated, some college graduates. I've had people with bachelor's degrees, advanced degrees, etc. Some people have just fallen on tough times due to no fault of their own, through a job loss or severe illness to a family member. My experience is many of these people do shop around. I'd like to point a couple examples out in my most recent letter, which is May. The one dated May 15th, example number one, Laura. She was a 43-year-old married payee with two children. The annuity was created when Laura was in a motor vehicle accident in 1987. She had 3 years of college, and she sold one lump sum payment to make a down payment on a house. Her husband was a bicycle mechanic in the community. They did not have real high income, but they wanted to put as much money down as they could to get the house. Laura was a stay-at-home mom. She had a pre-qualification letter from a realtor and a lender showing that if she had these down payment funds that she could have purchased the home. And this was a tough county. This was in Klamath County. And I suggested to Laura, I said, go get an attorney, you know, hire an attorney to come with you to court because I think that'll help, you know, alleviate any concerns the judge will have. And that was approved. The other example that sticks out is number nine in my letter, and that is a gentleman named Michael. Michael was 29 years old. He had two children. This was in Lane County with Judge Carlson. He had some college. His wife was a stay-at-home mother due to their daughter's illness. The annuity was created many years earlier due to William's mother being in an accident in 1984. So the payments were not set up for a direct physical injury to Michael, but for his mother. He shopped around for the best offer, and his daughter had some severe health concerns, and many of these medical bills were in collections. They were getting harassing phone calls at night, threats of lawsuits, and Michael sold those payments to take care of those needs. Judge Carlson was very thorough. And at the end of the hearing, Michael did say to me, he said, wow, I'm really shocked that I had to go through that process because I'm just trying to get money to take care of my my daughter's concerns. I wanted Michael to come with us. I called him to see if he'd be willing to testify. He said, Roger, that was the most humiliating experience I went through in my life. It's behind me. I don't want to relive it. It was tough enough as it was. I agree with Julie. If we ran into an individual that had some kind of traumatic brain injury, I'd want to make sure that, you know, they were checked out by a physician. And I've actually had scenarios when I've talked to customers, I call them upon receipt of the file, and then as I prepare them for court, I've had a couple occasions, not here in Oregon, but in other states, where I've found out that somebody does not have, in my opinion, the cognitive ability to proceed. And I tell my clients, I'm not handling it. I'm not taking this case forward because I don't want my reputation on the line. These judges know me, they respect me, and I bring them good cases. I think there is a misunderstanding that judges are maybe rubber stamping these cases. That's not true, and I'd like to briefly, as an example, use Ms. Simpson, who's here today. I personally have never handled a transfer that was approved for Ms. Simpson. I did file one time for her for an ASC member. It was in, I believe, Josephine County, and as I queried her, I found out she didn't live there. And I immediately dismissed that case because my reputation is on the line. I told my clients, I'm not taking this forward. She doesn't live there. I did handle another case that was filed in Douglas County and went before Judge Garrison. And Judge Garrison, as Julie indicates, asked very tough questions. And as the hearing unfolded, I think Ms. Simpson wanted the funds to help her daughter, and Judge Garrison's concern was, well, that's for your daughter. It's not in your best interest. And he had a concern that she didn't accurately reflect what her income was. She had some other annuity payments. And in all due respect to Ms. Simpson, the judge used the perjury word, that she probably perjured herself. He denied it. The system worked. He wrote a 3-page denial order that was very detailed and said he didn't want to ever see her again. I immediately, after that was over, emailed all my clients and said, this lady just got denied. Here's the facts and circumstances of the case. The judge was concerned that maybe she wasn't totally truthful about her income. I'm not handling it. She's probably going to call you because she got denied. I'm not touching it. I'm done. So the system works in those scenarios. These judges are smart. They know what they're doing. They ask the right questions. They're on the bench for a reason, and they're on the bench because they're very smart attorneys and got appointed because of that ability. I'm very thorough in my presentation to the court. I tell them about the payee's education level, their income, whether there's medical needs, the family makeup, and a number of kids, whether they've done prior transfers, remaining payments, the use of funds. So I think the concerns that the proponents are putting forth, I address those at the hearing. Some of the problems I see with the bill is it will add additional time. Right now, the courts in Oregon the court staff's overworked. And in some counties, Lane County is a good example. When you file a case, when you send it down there, I can call and say, well, I've got FedEx proof that the papers got there yesterday. It takes sometimes upwards of 2 weeks to even get a case number, and then and only then can you set a hearing, and it's subject to the judge's availability. Judge Carlson Hill hears in Lane County, many other counties, they're randomly assigned, and I've had situations where maybe a particular judge who's assigned a file is involved in a lengthy trial and is trying to wrap that up, and I may not have a hearing for weeks. So time is of the essence. These people are faced with difficult scenarios. Delay means maybe more money owed in a mortgage default, et cetera. Just real quickly, on the other proposal, I know one of them is to put forth someone's income in the application. I think that's very intrusive. Number 7 on my example, Patricia, she and her husband was an ER doctor in Benton County. They had over a $300,000 family income, and I'm sure that's something she would not want in a public document. That information, the judges ask those questions, it's on the record, but it's not in a public document that somebody can walk in off the street and look at. I agree with Julie. The law works. It does work. Judges know how to ask the right questions. There are denials. I've had denials happen. I think Julie's comment in her written testimony where it says it's unfortunate that the small number of attorneys practicing in this area in Oregon were not brought into the conversation about the Oregon Act prior to the development of HB 2536. Again, it's working, and I wish we would have been consulted to answer any questions, but we deal with it firsthand day to day, and I'm hopeful if there's any additional questions, I can answer those for the committee.
Mr. Robe, my name is Earl Nesbitt. I'm here on behalf of the National Association of Settlement Purchasers. We are the only trade association that represents the secondary market for structured settlements. Mr. Romaine just whispered in my ear that I have 5 minutes. I can barely say goodbye in 5 minutes. I'm from Texas and we talk slow, so I'm going to try to hit the highlights. I could literally talk about this proposed legislation for 2 hours. There are that many problems with it from a practical perspective. When we first learned of this, we sat down with Representative Holvey, and we said, look, we'll work with you if we need to improve it. We're still willing to do that or to sit with this committee. Representative Holvey said something during that meeting that he said, well, we need to give more ammunition or information to the judges to deny these transfers. Now, I was scared of Representative Hovey at the time because I thought he'd get mad at me, so I didn't say what I thought. But what I thought was, what he really meant to say, or what he should have meant to say, was we need to give judges more information to consider these transfers. But no, I think the purpose of this is to discourage, to humiliate the payees, to make it more difficult for them to do these transactions. And therefore, our efforts at trying to find a compromise with the proponents have been met with complete resistance. We are proposing the Dash 7 amendments, if that's what this committee wants to do, to consider some information. And I will tell you, it does 85 to 90% of what the proponents say they want to do, but it does so in a reasonable manner. Let me just touch on a couple things. Senator Roblin, you asked a question about could the court, when approving these transactions, put in information that says you can't assign these. In fact, yes, the court can. But that's one of the myths. People believe that the structured settlement transfers are routinely approved by courts. They're not. A small percentage of those involving minors or people incompetent. The vast majority of structured settlements involve out-of-court settlements where people that make the decision as part of the settlement discussion to accept payments over time rather than small payments, rather than a lump sum. And so in those cases where someone's incompetent or when it's a minor, yes, the judge can do that. Do they do it? No, for the most part, because you can't predict the future and circumstances change. And they, as Jack Mulligan said, people have to have flexibility. Just real quick, last year in Oregon, our members did 159 transactions. That's not a lot. But for those 159 people, I can tell you those transactions were extremely important. Other companies, we represent about 90% of the market. Probably other companies do some in Oregon, and I would estimate that a total of about 200 transactions we're doing. These two fine attorneys to my right handle 90% of those transfers. They know what goes on in a day-to-day basis, and they've shared with you their experiences. Very quickly, we have a 17-page chart. 18-page chart that has the current law, the amendments proposed by Representative Hovey, or the changes, or the engrossed House Bill 2536, our amendments, and explanatory notes. And it's color-coordinated. It took me about 3 days to do this because I'm not computer efficient, but I think it will be helpful to you as you consider this, and I encourage you to read it. But I'm going to hit the highlights. Privacy issue of the payee. Their proposal is that you put all this information about income, children, financial resources, medical conditions in the petition, which is a publicly filed document, which our members are required under the statute to file. We say, no, that information comes out at the hearing, and that's fine. It should come out at the hearing, but don't make these people expose their whole life to these publicly filed documents. Their response to that is, well, you can file a motion to seal it. Well, I looked at the rule 2.1004, the process for sealing public pleadings, and it is expensive, time-consuming, and it simply will not occur. It requires an extra hearing, an extra motion. You got to segregate it, and the payees is the information to be protected. They're going to have to retain counsel and file that motion at the time the petition is filed. It simply doesn't work. Our proposal is simply you put basic information about the transaction and the payee in the petition, and then we have a provision which says at the hearing, the court may ask the payee to provide testimony or other evidence of their income, their children, child support, and we added one that says whether the payee relies exclusively on structured settlement payments, which they propose to transfer for the payee's necessary living expenses and or required medical care or treatment. So it's going to direct those judges that this is what you should inquire about at the hearing, but at least it keeps it out of the public record. The second thing that I want to touch on is they have added a 30-day admonishment. Current law says you provide a disclosure statement to the payee which sets forth the financial terms of the transaction, and that must be provided to them at least 3 days before they sign a transfer agreement. They propose to make that 10 days. We agree. more time. And remember, this is just a minimum amount. They can receive the disclosure statement and never sign a transfer agreement, and they do so often. And they can use that that disclosure statement to go get other offers, and they do so often. But what they want to do is, in addition to that, also add a 30-day admonishment, which is sent before there's any discussion of the terms of the transaction. We prepared a mock one, which we will provide. It provides no information other than to say, you're about to consider a transaction, you should get independent professional advice, you should consider other offers, and if you don't get independent professional advice, the court can force you to get it at the hearing and can force you to pay for it. It is a irrelevant document. It will not provide any information. Instead, what we say is put the information about the admonishment of independent professional advice in the disclosure that has the terms of the transaction that they're considering. And put in that disclosure, in writing, you should consider other offers, you should consider other alternatives to raise the money. Tell them that. They do it anyway. We don't mind that, but we think it should be done at the beginning of the process and not court required at the end of the process. And finally, there's a 10-day rescission period, and we have proposed adding language that as a required finding of the court, when they go to court, the court must ask the payee, do you still want to do this transaction? And the payee must acknowledge that they do. If they do not, they cannot make that express finding. They cannot approve the transaction. What that means is the payee has a right of rescission right up until the end, to the day of the hearing, and we're fine with that. Finally, they set forth a lengthy list of what the judge shall consider at the hearing. Kind of hit on your point, prescribing what they shall consider. We change that a bit and say, we provide a list of things that the judge may consider, including but not limited to. And our list is is pretty much the same with a couple of exceptions. Remember, we say that the court should consider and must make a finding that they don't rely on this for their medical care or necessary expenses. What they ask is that the court must consider what the parties to the original settlement, which may not have even involved the payee because they may have inherited it, 20, 30, 15 years ago, intended with respect to the settlement. Well, I'm a lawyer, and when I see something that the court has to make a finding about, then I know I have to present evidence of that. There is no way to present evidence of what the parties to the settlement 20 years ago intended when they did the settlement. I can tell you what they intended. The defendant wanted to settle as cheaply as possible, and the plaintiff wanted to settle for as much as possible. That's what they intended. If they want to set up trust, they can do that. There's things called special needs trust. Those transactions don't get done in these. The other thing that, and I'm sorry, I know you're looking at the time, what I got, about 30 seconds?
I'll let you know.
Okay. As I said, we are fine with the court considering at the hearing their income, what they're going to use it for, whether they're transferring partial payments or monthly or lump sums. Those are all things that the judges consider now. We're fine with putting that in there. What we don't want to do is make it so intrusive and impossible, and we don't want to preordain these transactions to fail. The other thing is that they have asked, and I touched on this earlier, they've said, included in their factors for the court to consider, is whether the transfer has considered other offers, the payee, and if not, then the court can stop the hearing and require them to do so. And they say that's no big deal. That's a huge deal. Remember, by the time when the person calls us, usually, or not usually, but often, they need the money yesterday. They have lost their job, they have a foreclosure, they have bills for funeral bills or whatever. And so when they call us, they are shocked to find out, because they're never told when they enter into a structured settlement that if they ever want to liquidate this, they have to go to court. They're shocked to find out they got to go to court. The process takes anywhere from 60 to 120 days or longer now from the moment that they decide that they want to go for it. Now they want to add in on to that a 30-day admonishment, which is going to extend that. And then once our members go through all this process, come to an agreement, send the disclosure, send the admonishment, hire counsel, file the petition, pay the filing fee, get a hearing, go to the hearing, and we get there and the judge says, did you consider other offers? Says, no, judge, I have worked with this company before. I'm comfortable with them. I like them. They're local, or they're in Washington State, or they're in Texas, God forbid, or somewhere that they like them, and I want to go with them. Well, they've been admonished in writing in advance to do all that. And if they choose not to then say, give the court the ability to say, well, I'm not going to let you go forward unless you consider two other offers, that impacts our members. We've spent a lot of time, effort, and money there, and now we're basically opening up to an auction. And I can tell you it doesn't work, because what happens is the person's annoyed that they are being told at this point that they have to go out and consult with other offers. They go out and they call these other companies, and so someone says, yeah, we'll give you $500 more. More likely, they're going to say, wait a second, you're doing this because the judge ordered to you? I'm not going to make a proposal, because I know I'm just a stalking horse here. It doesn't work. It's unfair to our member companies to incur all that cost. Absolutely, absolutely tell them, consider other offers up at the beginning. But don't wait till we get to the 11th hour and delay the process. And I will say this, if they decide...
2 minute warning.
Good. If they decide that they're going to... I was a quarterback in high school and I was never good at the 2 minute warning. Which is why I'm a lawyer now. If they do that, it's not fair to our members to require them to do that. And if they do go out and find someone else who's going to pay them $500 more, guess what? They have to start the entire process over again, because they have to get the 30-day admonishment. That company's got to find a new funding company. We're not saying this is a very competitive business. As you can see by the discount rates, 6%, 8%, 10%, these people are doing that. We're not saying don't tell them to do it up front, but don't wait and say to us, spend all this money, spend all this time, and then get to the and then let the judge overrule the person's personal decision. I could go on for another. I wish we had overtime, but we don't. All I will say is we have tried our best to work with the proponents of this bill to reach a compromise. That did not work. I don't think it was from a lack of effort. I've got mounds of paper that I've shared. I will be happy to work with anyone on this committee, and I will be happy to go back in a room with them. But we need someone there to say, this makes sense. If you get a chance, read this, our comments particularly.
We'll get it to you. I've got it in the briefcase. I forgot to bring it up.
All right.
If you get a chance, read this, and I think you'll see we're being reasonable here.
Earl,
make the bill work.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank
questions.
You.
Questions. All right. I've got some. Okay. Let's start off with, for the two attorneys, you get a call from your client, which is one of the factoring companies. They say there's an individual who's interested in doing this. Walk me through the process of how you make contact with that person.
Can we go first? Okay. Well, typically, by the time I get a new file, my client has already negotiated the transaction with the customer, and I'll get a file sent to me, usually email, sometimes FedEx. It'll have the contract, the disclosure statement. I always want to know, as part of my protocol, if it's not in the materials, have they done it before? Have they ever been denied? If they've been denied, I want to see a denial order. What payments do they have left, and what is the rate? There's typically an affidavit that sets forth the use of funds, and I'll pick up the phone and I'll call the customer and introduce myself. Hi, I'm Roger Dunaway. I'm attorney for ABC Company. I received your file today. I want to verify. Can you tell me what you're doing with this money?
Okay.
And so, I walk them, and I want to make sure it right. makes, they tell me
all
the
right.
truth.
So you got the file.
Yes, sir.
That. What do you tell that individual as to your relationship to them versus your client?
Absolutely. Part of my protocol, and I make it very clear, like beating him over the head, I'm not your lawyer. I'm the lawyer for the funding company. I will answer questions for you. However, I would encourage you, as set forth in the paperwork, to get your own counsel if you wish, if you can afford it. And some people do, CPA, financial advisor, et cetera. But I also explain the process. You're in XYZ County. I have to file it. It typically takes them a week or so to give me a case number, an OGIN number, and an assigned judge. Then I have to pick up the phone and call that judge's assistant, and then the hearing date has to be at least 20 days away. So I will let you know when I have that. Is there any days that are bad for you? Like, do you get off work on a Tuesday? So I'll try to schedule it to convenience.
Do you actually give them something in writing and have them sign that they know what the relationship is between you and them? In the sense of, do you require it in writing that they acknowledge that you are not their attorney?
I, Senator, no, I've not given them anything in writing.
Okay.
But I do make that. I have a very detailed protocol, and that's something I always go over with them more than once.
All right. And regarding this potential, I'm not saying it happens, but potential judge shopping, in the sense of if a person has been through a process before in a particular county where, and they still live in that county. When you, if you're going to represent them a second time, is there some notice in that petition that the person has been already given some type of structured settlement transfer?
I do make a notation in the pleadings where I say Mr. Smith has been involved in prior transactions. Okay. And I don't sometimes, Senator, have a lot of the details because it may have been where they lived in California and did it, then moved up here, or they did it with somebody that's not my client. But I tell the customer, you need to be prepared to, at the hearing, tell the judge these things: when you did it, how much you sold, what you got, and what you did with the money. Because I've told him or her, the judge, in that application, you've done it before. Because I don't have, and even if it was somebody I handled 4 or 5 years earlier, I may not remember the facts. So I tell the customer, you need to be prepared to address this because the judge will want to know. And I've told the judge in my pleadings that you've done it before.
Okay. Other questions, comments? All right, I want to thank everyone. And what I'm going to do at this point, let me just put this on the record. First of all, it's not an either or. I understand there's two different proposals from hearing Representative Hovey. He had one that was rejected, as what he said, that was on the House side. I've got now the Dash 7s, so we will be meeting. So what I want to do is for the opponents, since you are, at least I think one of you is from Texas, that actually might be going back, and I don't know if you want to be here or not, I want to try to set some time tomorrow morning around my schedule so we can sit down and kind of go through some other stuff I don't want to do on the record at this point.
Okay.
And then what I'm going to do for the proponents is set up another time with them to do the same thing, and then we're going to see what we can get that's going to be hopefully amenable to everybody as best we can. All right, any other comments or questions? All right. Paul?
No, thank you. I was just going to say thank you.
All right.
Yes, thank you.
All right, so that's where we're at now. So this is for the committee. We do not have activity or, let's say, bills that we need to hear on Monday. So what I'm going to do is not have a committee meeting on Monday, and that will give me some flex time to probably continue to work on this.
And other things.
And other things, exactly. All right. So with that, if there's nothing else, we're going to first close the public hearing on House Bill 2536A. I want to thank everyone for coming forward and being orderly, and we are going to work the bill to see if we can reach resolution. And with that, we are adjourned until Tuesday as a committee.
Thank you. Thank you.